it said. But then she saw that the letter was addressed to Patrick. Nora ripped it open. "Patrick, you won't remember me, but I know you're in pain, and that so much in your life feels confusing. If you ever have questions, I might be able to help answer them. Don't hesitate to contact me at the address above. Yours, Mother Cecilia Flynn. P.S. I include a medal given to you when you were born. I hope you'll wear it for protection. I believe in its powers. I should never have taken it in the first place. I'll tell you the story, if and when we speak." Nora's chest tightened. She crumpled the letter in one hand. In the other, she held the medal. She had had no confidence, no voice, as a girl. She was timid. Perhaps Teresa thought she hadn't changed. But Nora's children had made her tough. On their behalf, she was able to do whatever needed doing. She spread out the page and read the note over again and thought, "You will never be allowed to know my family now. Teresa, what have you done?" Chapter 17. Nora was on her back, bare legs stretched out before her, propped up on her elbows so she could see John and Bridget at the ocean's edge. Beside her on the blanket, the baby lay on his stomach in just a diaper. Brian was threatening to walk soon. When that day came, she knew she'd never rest. It was the 4th of July. Charlie had the day off. After breakfast, before it got too hot, they had taken the children to Paragon Park. Patrick refused to join them. But John and Bridget were gleeful, whooping around in dizzying circles on the tilt-a-whirl, rushing down the high peaks of the flume ride, their T-shirts and shorts getting soaked. They let them each spend $5 in the arcade. John used all his money on skee-ball, trying to beat Bridget's high score, which he eventually did. He always had to be the best, a quality Nora disliked in him. Charlie thought the boy would be president one day. He said John was the smartest of their children. And though Nora didn't disagree, she thought there was such a thing as too much praise. She didn't want him to get a big head. She told Charlie it wasn't right to favor one child over the others, and he just laughed. "What?" Nora said. "You with your St. Patrick," he said. After the arcade, they came to the beach. Nora had bought Bridget a new bathing suit for the season, blue with sparkling gold stars. Bridget wore it now, beneath one of Charlie's old undershirts, the white cotton draping off her like a sail. She insisted on wearing the shirt, even in the water. Nora sighed. She picked up her book to read, and then a shadow appeared, blocking the sun. Charlie. He wore khaki pants and a button-down shirt over his swim trunks. On his feet, a pair of sandals and thick black socks. Set against everyone else on the beach in all their revealing glory, he looked like a man from another century. Charlie held out a cup of frozen custard. "For you," he said. Nora took it, smiled up at him. "Sit." "I thought I might go back to the house and mow the lawn." They both knew he was going to check up on Patrick. "Come on," she said. "Sit for a while." Charlie plopped down beside her and tickled the baby's cheek. They were exhausted in the beginning, but so far they were having more fun than they'd ever had with the others. They felt at ease. They knew how to do it all. They'd done it 3 times before. They wouldn't get to do it again, so why fret about anything? Brian was the first baby she brought home from the hospital to a real house. It made such a difference, not having to carry the child up 3 flights just to get to your own front door. Back in Dorchester, when it snowed, Charlie had to shovel out a parking space in the street and fill it with garbage cans or a lawn chair when they drove off. On the coldest days, people would slash your tires if you dared to steal a spot. Now, they had a garage and a driveway and a backyard of their own, with no one looking down at them from above. She could sit out there in her nightgown if she liked and drink a cup of tea with the baby on her shoulder. In Hull, Charlie's relatives couldn't stop by at all hours on their way to church or coming home in the evening. They had fewer house guests, since not so many cousins wanted to stay so far from the city. Nora could read a book after dinner. There was a tiny room on the second floor that she claimed for herself. She had initially thought to put the baby in there. They had 4 real bedrooms besides. But as soon as they got to Hull, Patrick said he wanted to sleep in the attic. Knowing all that he had been through and how little he wanted to be there, she thought she might as well let him have his way. So what was meant to be Patrick's room became the nursery, and the nursery, which wasn't big enough for a child anyway, became her sitting room. Each time Nora went in there and closed the door, she got a rush. Without her needing to say so, Charlie somehow knew not to bother her there. He'd stay downstairs watching television after the children went to bed. They still saw the family often, driving up to Boston almost every week for a wedding or a birthday party or a first communion. Nora had 35 Raffertys at her house for Christmas Eve. When she came down in her bathrobe the next morning, half of them were still there. Piled on the kitchen table was a stack of hostess gifts as tall as she was, more bottles of Bailey's and boxes of chocolate than they could ever hope to consume. She had 70 people for a luncheon after Charlie's uncle died in the spring. The relatives marveled over how much space she had in the cupboards, over the big backyard, and the size of the bedroom closets. When Nora and Charlie told them they were moving, some had acted offended, ever on alert for family members who thought they were better than the rest. "How can you swing a whole house on what you make?" Charlie's brother Lawrence asked, as if it were any of his business. "Who would want to live all the way out there?" Babs said. John and Bridget hadn't wanted to leave their cousins and friends behind, but they had adjusted well to Hull. Patrick less so. He hadn't made any friends at school. Nora accepted his somber disposition as something they would have to bear for now. She herself was happy here. She thought this could be the happiest time of her life, if not for Patrick's struggles. But as far as she had seen, life rarely let you be purely joyful. There was always something there to torture you, if you let it. She hadn't spoken to her sister in more than a year. Nora knew it was up to her to fix things. Teresa didn't have any way to reach her. Nora hadn't told her about the move. Sometimes she thought she was ready, but then the memory of what happened filled her with such anger. "Give it 1 more week," she told herself. 1 more month. At noon, Nora looked up from her paperback to see John running toward them. 2 young things in bikinis laid down towels a few feet away, and then began to cover their live bodies in oil. Nora wore the yellow bathing suit with a ruffle at the belly that she had been wearing for the past several years. It had stretched, but so had she with Brian, so it still fit her fine. John reached them out of breath, just as she was getting to the good part in her book. Nora pretended not to see him. "Are we going to drive into Boston for the fireworks tonight?" he asked for the 100th time. "If you're good," she said without looking up. John had been excited about the bicentennial ever since President Ford came to Boston in the spring to light a lantern at the Old North Church. A week ago, John insisted they hang red, white, and blue bunting on the front porch. "How do they make fireworks, Ma?" he said now. Nora sighed. "They do them off the side of a ship so no one gets hurt," she said. "You should never go near fireworks unless you're a professional. Boys get their fingers blown off." "But how did they get the fireworks in the air?"
"Gunpowder."
In truth, Nora had no idea. She thought gunpowder had something to do with it, but she couldn't remember what.
"Someone shoots a gun?" John said, wide-eyed.
"Yes." He nodded, then ran back to join Bridget in the water. Charlie gave her a look.
"Is that how it's done, then?"
She swatted him with her book.
"Well, you weren't any help."
By late afternoon, the crowd thinned, people going home for the day. The older kids needed to shower before they ate dinner and went into the city. The baby needed a nap. Bridget and John approached the blanket.
"We're bored," John said.
"How can you be bored with all this around you?" Charlie said. "My God."
"We're bored," John repeated.
"We should be getting home anyway," Nora said.
"No!"
the children shouted.
"Come play in the water with us, Ma," Bridget said. "It's too cold for me."
"It's not cold once you get used to it. Please?"
"Bridget, God gave you brothers so that I'd never have to go in the ocean if I didn't feel like it."
"Dad," Bridget said, "will you come in?"
"Ah, second fiddle, that feels nice," Charlie said. But he was already unbuttoning his shirt to expose the whitest chest in America.
"Just a dip," he said. "I've got me togs on underneath."
"Togs?" John exclaimed, embarrassed.
"Dad!"
"What am I supposed to call them?"
"Shorts? Swim trunks?"
Her husband pretended to consider this.
"I prefer togs, thank you."
"And those sandals," Bridget said. "You can't wear them with socks. No other father I know would do that."
"You two are very opinionated today," Charlie said as he got to his feet, peeling off the black socks.
The three of them ran toward the waves. The sounds of the amusement park were carried toward them on the wind, the tinkling music of the rides, the gleeful screams from the roller coaster. She watched as Charlie splashed the children, the two of them screaming, laughing.
Togs.
Nora's children took for granted what was once nearly unbelievable to her. They were being raised as Americans, but not by Americans. She had accepted that this was home. Charlie never had. Ever since he arrived in Boston, he talked about how he would one day return to Ireland. He told tall tales about the good old days. To listen to him, you'd never know how they struggled. Charlie refused to cultivate an interest in baseball, even though John and Bridget were obsessed. At Little League games, other fathers would be shouting at their sons from the bleachers, frenzied, red-faced. Charlie would be asleep. Nora cooked spaghetti and tuna noodle casserole and American chopped suey from recipes she clipped out of Good Housekeeping. Her husband wouldn't eat them. He went to Cayley's twice a month, dancing to the old Irish tunes with long lines of elderly ladies. He came home humming "The Stack of Barley," "The Siege of Ennis."
He insisted that Bridget do Irish step dance when she was young, though she barely lasted a year. Their new neighbors, Eileen Delaney and Betty Joyce and Dot McGuire, whose families had been in America for two or three generations, talked about being Irish more than anyone she had ever met. They collected bleak china painted with shamrocks. They wore claddock rings. They played the Clancy brothers at parties. As actual Irish people, Nora and Charlie were like celebrities to them. Charlie reveled in this, but it embarrassed Nora. When she left Ireland, she hadn't thought it would be forever. It hurt so much to recall all that was lost. Her father and grandmother had died without her ever seeing them again. They had only ever gotten to know her as a timid girl. Nora had lied to them to protect Teresa and, she supposed, herself. Without meaning to, she built a wall between the family she had made and the one from which she came. Her brother was still home on the farm. He never married. Martin was 19 when she left. Now he was almost 40. It seemed impossible. He sent her a photograph, and Nora cried to see that he was bald. She sent him one back, of the whole family on Easter morning. When her brother replied, he said he couldn't wait to see them all. Nora stared at the words, doubting he ever would. She sometimes yearned for Milltown Malby, for the smell of the air, the views from the cliffs off Spanish Point. They had so much space in the country. She could go days without seeing anyone besides her family. Now, there were people crammed in everywhere she looked. Certain cousins, having made as much money as they wanted or needed in America, had moved back for good. Others they knew had been to Ireland for visits. After Kitty came into her money, she went and kept going. Bab said Kitty only went home to brag. She wore a mink coat when her brother met her at the airport in Shannon and refused to take it off the entire trip. Una Donnelly wrote to Nora about it. "I saw a woman dressed to the nines in the square last night. I said to the children, 'Would you look at that?' Then I realized it was Kitty Rafferty, your sister-in-law. Didn't she look just like a film star?" Charlie said he would like to go, and Nora replied that it was too expensive. They couldn't leave the children. She could come up with 100 reasons why now wasn't the time, why home was not a place one went for a visit. They left the beach at 4 o'clock, the children pink-cheeked, freckles spreading across their faces. She had learned to keep a basin of water on the back porch, where they each took a turn dipping sandy feet. Nora opened the back door that led into the kitchen. There was Patrick, drinking a beer at the table. "What do you think you're doing?" she said.
"Toasting the 4th of July, he replied.
He tipped the chair backward onto two legs. Nora had never known a child like him, a boy with no fear. "You're 17, she said. Unbelievable that when she came to this country, she was only a few years older than he was now. Teresa was his age exactly. Patrick wanted so badly to be a man, but he was a child in every sense.
"Let him have one," Charlie said.
He raised a finger at Patrick.
"Hear me? One."
Charlie went upstairs to take a shower. Brian reached out for Patrick, and Patrick took him from Nora's arms. He loved the baby, and so she knew that he was good. "We'll grill dinner outside tonight," Nora said now, and then we're going into Boston for the fireworks. Will you come with us?
Patrick shook his head. Ma, I have plans.
Boys from school?
She held her breath while she waited for his response.
Nah, I'm going to Castle Island. Fergie and some other guys are going to hang out and watch the fireworks from there. I'll ride in town with you. Get the Ashmont line to Fields Corner.
I want you home right after.
We were going to go to Lucky Strike.
Bowling?
Yeah.
He could lie like that, right to her face. But what could she say? If she forbade him, Patrick would only go ahead and do it anyway.
I don't want to hear about any trouble, Nora said. I want you to be careful.
Ryan had fallen asleep on Patrick's shoulder. She took the baby from him and went upstairs to put him in his crib. She needed a miracle for that boy. She thought of her sister's silly medal.
I believe in its powers, Teresa had written in the letter she sent him.
Nora didn't quite, yet she had never been able to throw it away. She went into her room, opened her jewelry box. She found the medal where she had left it a year ago, hidden in a small satin bag stuffed with cotton. She found an old chain and threaded it through the loop at the top.
Nora returned to the kitchen, where Patrick sat alone.
I don't ask you for much, do I? She said. He smiled, uneasy.
No.
I need you to do something for me. If you think it's silly, that doesn't matter. You'll be a good boy and humor your mother.
All right, he said, just before she draped the chain around his neck.
You have to promise me that you will wear this always.
He laughed. Patrick, promise,
she said in her sternest voice, which still had never been enough to reach him. But now he looked up at her. He looked her in the eye.
I promise, he said.
Chapter 18. Mother Cecilia set a bud vase on the end table. The head of a fat white peony lolled at the top. She adjusted the stem right, then left, then straight up and down. When she pulled her hand away, the flower fell back to its original position. She cocked her head, regarded it. Then she heard the door to the guest house open and the sound of several pairs of feet in the front hall. The Sisters of St. Joseph came on retreat for one weekend each summer. It had always been her job to make sure their rooms were tidy, their beds made up, the windows thrown open to the sweet smell of the grass outside. She had placed a tray of just-baked muffins on the table for them and a pitcher of iced tea in the refrigerator. She made sure the kitchen was stocked with the Abbey's finest offerings, raw milk and cheese, jam, and several loaves of fresh bread. She had been prioress for more than a year now, second in command after the abbess. She knew she ought to pass this task along to one of the postulants, but she enjoyed it too much. Their friends in active orders got worn down by the world. Their communities were shrinking. They had elderly sisters to care for. All of it weighed on their minds. They came here to refuel, to breathe the fresh country air, to reflect on what a year had brought. She saw it as her duty to revive them. She went to the door to greet them, hugging and kissing them all. They didn't wear habits anymore. They wore plain skirts and jackets now, or dungarees with a smart silk blouse. It was 80 degrees outside. Mother Cecilia swore she would try not to envy them as she sweated away in her robes.
Sister Evangeline, the most outspoken of them all, held forth a tiny American flag.
"For the prioress," she said. As she took it, Mother Cecilia must have made a face that conveyed her confusion. Sister Evangeline laughed.
"It's the 4th of July."
"Is it?" The noontime bells rang. "I'm off," Mother Cecilia said. "Get yourselves settled. I'm so happy to see you all again."
"We'll see you over there," Sister Evangeline said.
Mother Cecilia went to join the others in the chapel, still holding the flag in her hand. She had no time to set it down. She hid it inside her sleeve and took her position. They chanted gloriously for their fellow sisters. She looked out and smiled at the visiting nuns lined up in the first pew on the other side of the gate. The nuns from the abbey ate lunch in the enclosure. They had prepared a beautiful meal for the Sisters of St. Joseph to have in the refectory. The usual 2 hours of silence followed, but later that afternoon, Mother Placid invited the sisters to have tea with the two of them in her private living room. Just before they arrived, she and Mother Cecilia set out cookies, milk, sugar cubes. The last abbess, in office for 42 years, had kept the room dark, with heavy drapes and velvet furniture, enormous couches and chairs that swallowed a person when she sat. Mother Placid lightened it up. She pulled down the drapes. The sun shone in now, onto oatmeal-colored sofas and a pair of bright blue wing-back chairs. She had gotten throw pillows, a floral rug. The first time Mother Cecilia saw it, she thought of Mother Placid's old apartment in Queens. Even there in that cold, blank building, she had created warmth. Home.
"Just a reminder," Mother Cecilia said. "We have to be aware of what we say to them. Our positions now demand it."
"We, huh?" Mother Placid said.
"All right, you, Mother Abbess."
The Sisters of St. Joseph spoke more frankly to them than most people would. Mother Placid had a tendency to get swept up in it, to say things she might later regret. Her friend smiled as the others knocked at the door.
"Come in, come in," they said.
They talked about the year gone by, about world affairs and family matters, about the fundraising efforts they had started for their retirement. They were heroic nurses who served the poor in Philadelphia. In the spring, they had lost the building their order had lived in for a century. Now the nuns lived in apartments spread all over the city.
"It's different," Sister Emily said, sipping her tea.
"It's awful," Sister Evangeline said. "It's not what we signed up for at all. We've lost our community. At the hospital, it's a new battle every day. The bishops make it impossible for us to do our work."
The others looked down, quiet for a minute.
"Should we open a bottle of wine?" Mother Placid said, and they all cheered. Mother Cecilia shook her head. 2 winters back, when Mother Placid had just been named abbess, there was a blizzard, power out to half the state. A homeless shelter in Manchester asked if the abbey might be able to take in 3 or 4 children for a week. Bishop Dolan, speaking on behalf of the Pope, said it was impossible, not what the abbey was there for. He said to tell the shelter that they would pray for the children.
"The bishop says we cannot take 3 or 4, Mother Placid said into the telephone as Mother Cecilia looked on. "He was very clear that we must not do that. So, we will take 10 or 12.
"Tell us," Mother Placid said now to the nuns. Sister Evangeline looked at the others.
"Go ahead," said Sister Rebecca,
We all know you have plenty to say.
We're in trouble. A few of us specifically, myself included. They're after us for telling some female patients that they should be using birth control, telling them that it's not a sin. And though they can't get it from us, we can tell them where to get it.
Oh, this again, Mother Placid said. She was on her feet, pulling glasses from the hutch in the corner, handing them around. Mother Cecilia tensed up.
You can't imagine coming face to face with a woman who can't feed the children she already has and having to tell her that God insists she have more, Sister Evangeline said. The bishops have never been in that room.
But we have to do what the church dictates, Sister Emily said.
Our gift to the church is to be with the people on the margins, people who are suffering. We can't afford to see things in black and white, Sister Evangeline said. It's 1976. Abortion is not the only ill. War and hunger are also right-to-life issues.
We know how it is, Mother Placid said. We understand. She filled Sister Evangeline's glass.
For this, they call us radicals, heretics.
What nonsense, Mother Placid said. But we need look no further than our history books for reassurance. Nuns have triumphed over a delinquent leadership before. It's a common enough mistake to believe that one's own time is the most progressive, the most advanced, that human nature only improves upon itself. But in fact, things move in cycles, good to bad, and back again. Mother Cecilia gave her a pleading look. The bishop had said they could not be seen as supporting nuns like these in their efforts, even though they did support them. It was one thing to listen, and even that was a danger. But Mother Placid had no business getting into a conversation. Even in this company, maybe especially so, they had to be mindful of whom they served. They could speak freely only to one another. 14 years ago now, Pope John the 23rd had told the clergy to open the windows of the church, but there had been little more guidance than that. Members were meant to revisit their founders' intentions, to revise their constitutions, to modernize. Nuns on the outside went back to their given names. They stopped wearing the habit. Inside the cloister, they were supposed to be more obedient, more conservative than ever.
I envy you, Sister Evangeline said. You don't have to deal with any of this, the politics of it all.
There are people who think we're not doing much up here, just praying all day, Mother Placid said, a hint of defensiveness in her tone. We don't have a hospital or a school, but we have our doors open, and we greet the world there.
I know, Sister Evangeline said. I didn't mean... You've had all these young people running around here for the last few years, one of the others said. Surely it comes up when they talk to you. Maybe by being so traditional, by escaping notice, this is the only place where anything truly radical can happen.
Mother Cecilia smiled, betraying nothing. Whatever it is, it's worked, Sister Emily said. You brought in so many young recruits. It's a real success story, and all thanks to you two. You must be the youngest prioress and abbess in the country. They were 36 and 42, respectively. Sometimes Mother Cecilia thought a 36-year-old had no place being in a role of such importance. She nearly said so, but then Sister Evangeline said, "You deserve to be elected. You saved this place."
In the early 70s, they had nearly lost the abbey. After the deaths of several senior nuns, their numbers were shrinking. Their cash reserves were low. The roof leaked. One of the barns was ready to collapse. They didn't have the funds to repair it. They kept the heat and the lights in the church turned off, even during Mass. In winter, they wore coats over their habits. They could see their breath as they sang. Their meals, which had once been ample, became simple, sparse. They had to sell whatever they could get out of the dairy. They lived off of clear soups and vegetables and bread. Everyone lost weight. Without the gardens, they might have starved. But then they were visited by an intervention of the spirit. They had 400 acres. From time to time, outsiders staked their claim on far-off corners of the property. The nuns mostly let them alone. But when groups of young people started camping on the land, pitching tents, staying for weeks, they debated whether to tell them to leave. In the dormitory at midnight, they could hear guitars, laughter from across the fields. On a cool autumn evening, the nuns might smell a campfire as they walked to the chapel for vespers. The young people seemed to think they were hiding. When a nun caught sight of them, the girls in their skimpy skirts, their flowing dresses, the boys loud and long-haired, they would freeze a moment like deer and then run off. Finally, Mother Placid approached them and said they could stay, but they had to work, and they had to talk. That's how it began. They were mostly college students or recent graduates, intrigued by Daniel Berrigan and the notion of priests burning draft files, repulsed by the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy, and later by Kent State. They were weary. The abbey provided a refuge. They were the youngest people the nuns had seen in years. Their spirits enlivened the place. Soon they came by the dozens, men and women alike. They hungered for peace and community. They wanted to give more to the land than they took. They wanted to learn about communal living, and who better to teach them? The boys painted the buildings, repaired the roof. It was an odd sight. Handsome young men in blue jeans and t-shirts, where there were usually no men at all. Some of the nuns prayed for the strength to resist temptation. The girls worked alongside the nuns in the dairy and the gardens. Mother Placid had a gift with them. Most weren't much older than the children they had taught back in Queens. They were not particularly interested in God at the start. None of them came intending to stay. But several of them did. They represented a new generation at the Abbey, a repopulation. As with every major change, there was fierce debate at first. The oldest nuns feared that to embrace such girls was madness, desperation. But Mother Placid saw that the world was changing. They needed to change along with it, or they would perish. "There are as many paths to God as there are souls on earth," she said in a meeting with the Abbey's hierarchy. This seemed to move them. Afterward, Mother Cecilia said, "That was beautiful, the way you put it." "I agree," Mother Placid said, "but don't be too impressed. That's not me. It's Rumi." Mother Placid convinced them of that and more. The young people all came for parlors. When Mother Cecilia met with them in private, she was amazed at how open they were. They wanted someone to listen. The women, 18, 19, 20 years old, reminded her of herself when she first visited the abbey. She remembered how it worked. The first time you spoke with a nun, all you saw was her habit. But if the connection was strong enough, by the second or third conversation, you stopped noticing. You might talk for an hour, say your goodbyes, and later wonder if she had even had her head covered, though you knew she must have. You were surprised that the nuns did not proselytize or try to get them to see the light. They just listened. Some only came once or twice, but the ones who returned again and again began to realize on their own that the conversations were about God, even if he was never mentioned. God through the lens of their own lives. Perhaps their early experience with the church, if they'd had any, was something different. How easily she could recall the fear of arriving late to St. Joseph's in Milltown Malby, where Father Donahue would single a person out in front of the congregation if she came in a minute past the hour. A handful of angry parents asked what exactly the nuns were teaching their daughters. What had their faith meant to them before? A white dress for communion? A cake with a crucifix piped in buttercream? Simply what they were born to. But now they saw more. The girls who wanted to stay begged to join immediately, but the nuns told them it was too soon. Better to experience something first, just to fill out their humanity, to become whole people, but also to let them have something for the community when they returned. They went off and got degrees. They worked in activism or teaching or the arts. They traveled the world. They kept in touch. She knew they would return when the time was right. If some of them never came back, that too would be the right decision. Her own early confidant, Mother Lucy Joseph, had died in her sleep in the spring of 1967. It was April, and they were preparing to bless the gardens on the feast of St. Mark. They buried her with the others behind the chapel under the blooming magnolia trees. Mother Cecilia swore she felt her spirit each time she set foot in the Abbey's vegetable garden, or when she went to the grave and placed flowers in springtime. And especially when, in the presence of some lost soul, she attempted to give her solace. As many paths to God as people on earth. There was a girl named Angela with long, straight hair to her waist. "I love it here," she said in a parlor, their third together. "It's so nice to get a chance just to spend time with my girlfriends in the guest house, to get away from the stresses of life. Our guy friends are here, too, in the men's guest house. We can walk around together, work together without all the pressures of immediately figuring out if we want to go to bed with a person, which is increasingly part of the deal. I'm sorry. I don't mean to be shocking. My mother says I live for the shock value, but it's not true, I swear. I just say what I'm thinking." Mother Cecilia could laugh, stepping out of her skin, wanting to tell them that she had been a girl once herself. She was not so old that she couldn't remember. "I think I know what you mean," she said. When they asked about sex, she was supposed to tell them not to have it. But that felt like a lie. She didn't offer an opinion unless they asked her straight out if it was wrong. Then she told them that it was, and that they shouldn't stand in the way of God's plans. Every time she said it, a catch in her throat. A memory of a hospital room in Boston, of the consequences of the thing she had done, which had felt like nothing consequential at the time. "My parents asked me what I'm doing here," Angela went on. "I told them. I talked to Mother Cecilia.
She's teaching me how to be happy. You must have had hundreds of bedraggled hippies tell you their stories by now. You know all the secrets. Who's brokenhearted or falling in love or dropping out of school? You could write a book. She had begun to see patterns in what the young women worried about. It so often came down to sex. They regretted it. Not the act itself, but what came after. Though the young ones were responsible for shifting her mind, rattling her preconceptions, it was an older woman, older than her, who truly changed her way of looking at it. Until then, when they asked about birth control, Mother Cecilia towed the party line. But one day, she was out in the driveway pulling groceries from the trunk of Mother Annabelle's car when a woman drove past, slowly, looking at her. She turned the car around at the entrance to the gift shop. Mother Cecilia supposed she had made a wrong turn. But the woman was still looking. Mother Cecilia waved. She pulled to a stop when she reached her, rolled down her window. "I got lost," she said. "Can I give you directions back to the highway?" "No, I'm not a Catholic. Not anymore, I mean. I was, once." "Well, that's all right. We give directions to all denominations." She was trying to make a joke, but the woman didn't seem to hear. "When I saw the Abbey here, I took it as a sign. I guess I'm wondering if I might be able to talk to someone." "I'm very happy to talk to you." "Do nuns hear confession?" "We have parlors. We can't absolve you of anything, but we can listen." A few minutes later, they were sitting in one of the small rooms on opposite sides of the grill. "Do you need to say a prayer first?" the woman said. "Should I kneel?" She laughed. "Heavens, no. Just talk." Her name was Gloria. As a teenager, she had been sent off to a home for unwed mothers. After she gave birth and the time came to hand over the child, she begged to be allowed to keep her. Her parents told her that to move on, to forget, was the only reasonable plan. But she never could forget. Her life spun apart. She married an abusive man and divorced him. She sank into a depression and found no work for years. Now that baby would be 18. Gloria still thought about her. She agonized over where the child had ended up. She had no idea of the circumstances. She swore all the time that she saw her daughter in the street, at the bank. "God forgive me for saying it, but I wish I had just found a way not to be pregnant anymore," she said. Mother Cecilia was met with a memory. Kitty Rafferty, Charlie's sister, her roommate in Boston all those years ago. Kitty had wanted her to take that path. She understood what it would cost to lose a child you had brought into the world, held in your arms. "Do you know how many of us there were?" Gloria continued. "Thousands and thousands, forced to hand our babies over. How do they expect us to go on like it's nothing?" "I don't know," Mother Cecilia said. "Truly, I don't." "And what about the children?" Gloria said. "A whole generation of them, growing up, never knowing who their mothers were." She wished she could tell Gloria her own story, that she might pass through the grate and hold her hand. God had placed them together for a reason. She had always felt guilty, as if what happened had only happened to her, something she brought on herself.
But now she thought of her roommates and all the other girls at St. Mary's lined up in the hall when the doctor came. For the first time, she felt angry. For the choices denied her, the things thrust upon her. And Nora, too. They were part of some larger system they knew nothing about at the time. Nora had made the sacrifice for them all. She hoped Patrick would know, someday, how selfless her sister had been. From then on, when the young ones asked, she told them to protect themselves, their hearts first and foremost, but all the rest as well. She knew it was a radical decision, one that could get the Abbey excommunicated. It was as serious a thing as that. But she reminded herself that they served a higher power than man. Everything they had done was from love, the love of God, the love of this place, and the love of one another. They would do the right thing, but quietly. A Benedictine took three vows: stability, obedience, and conversatio morum, a conversion of life. All three bound them to the Abbey and to their community, but the conversatio morum also asked that a nun be willing to change. She still believed that what happened with Patrick was a miracle. She knew his life with Nora was what was best for him, even though when Nora told her about his struggles, she got nervous. She couldn't imagine him in some stranger's home. She knew the Blessed Mother had been in that room, had given her the strength, and that the moment had led her here. God met you where you were. He showed you his face when you needed him most. She prayed that soon enough he would meet her Patrick. It was with all her learned knowledge and experience that she had greeted her sister a year ago. A moment Mother Cecilia had prayed for. Letters were lovely, but nothing was a substitute for being together. She had written to Nora when she was elected prioress, told her how they held a beautiful ceremony in her honor. But Nora didn't even mention it in her reply. She wanted to tell Nora how Mother Placid's big mouth often made her feel the way Nora must have when they were girls, and she was always saying whatever came to mind. She wanted to tell her so many things. But Nora seemed, from her letters, to be frantic, busy, overwhelmed. Mother Cecilia told her to come for a retreat, and Nora brushed it off as if it was an absurd and frivolous idea. I couldn't leave the children for that. There were things she needed to say face to face. Since Nora started telling her about Patrick's troubles, she had thought that what he needed now was their honesty. She had learned over time that to know anything was bearable. It was secrecy that could not be borne. She wanted to free her sister of that burden, and Patrick, too. He was practically a man now. It was time. She still felt this way, but she shouldn't have said what she did. She could tell from the moment she saw Nora that her sister wouldn't be responsive to it. She regretted what she had said about Nora's marriage. Once, years earlier, she said to Mother Placid, "Imagine living your whole life out with a man just because once, when you were both impossibly young, he kissed you on the way home from a dance." But her own words, as she heard herself say them, didn't sit with her. It occurred to her then
But that wasn't why Nora had married Charlie at all. She had married him for her, for Patrick. This was what she wanted to say to Nora, that she understood. But the words got twisted. They came out as an accusation. The things Nora said stayed with her. I see right through you, Teresa. I will never know how you sleep at night. This is where you choose to hide. She was inconsolable after Nora left. She went to Mother Placid, told her what had happened. She regretted rushing in without listening, which wasn't her way. Not anymore. Part of her wished she had just taken Patrick on Nora's terms. She wished she had told Nora how the nuns prayed for him every morning at Mass during the prayers of the faithful. Each day at dawn, she slipped his name into the box of intentions. When the priest said, "For Patrick Rafferty," the entire congregation called back, "Lord, hear our prayer." On certain days, Mother Cecilia swore it was loud enough to reach him. She regretted most of all that letter to Patrick, sent in haste, desperation, after Nora left. She had thought in the moment that the medal might be one way she could help him. She wanted him to know that God had used it to guide them both to the places where they belonged. She thought she knew what was best. She had written and written to her sister to try to make amends, but her letters were all returned. She got permission to make a phone call, but the line in Dorchester was disconnected. She hoped Patrick wore the medal. She hoped he was doing better now, that it had only been a momentary lapse, a mistake born of youth. She prayed for Nora to come back to her and tell her. Each morning, first of all, she prayed for this. Mother Cecilia was in bed, long since asleep, when a crashing sound jolted her awake. She looked into the silent hall, then out the window. She thought she could make out figures standing below. She pulled on her robe and went down. The Sisters of St. Joseph stood on the dewy lawn, barefoot in their nightgowns, looking up. Sister Evangeline pointed skyward.
"Fireworks," she said. "They're pulling out all the stops for the bicentennial."
"Where are they lighting them?"
"Probably just on one of the local farms," she said.
"Some bored teenage boys," someone said.
With that, she thought of Patrick. Any thought of him, a thought of her sister. Her life was blessed, joyful. She was utterly content, but for the lack of them. Sometimes she missed a baby boy who didn't exist, who was almost a man now, with such a sharp yearning that it shocked her. Sometimes she indulged in what-ifs. If Patrick had come into the world now, in an age of greater understanding, she might have kept him. Had she been just a bit older, had she had her life established, maybe she would have fought harder. She knew there was no point in thoughts like these. It had happened when it happened. The moment a woman was born determined so much of who she was allowed to become. Mother Cecilia regarded the pure black sky sprinkled with stars. Twin sun blossoms exploded gold, bursting forth from the center, showering down in glorious, glittering, slow motion. Some of her fellow nuns had been drawn to the windows. They gazed out through the screens, and she waved up to them. After so many years, they were the ones she knew best. Her memories were mostly of them, a snowy afternoon when they abandoned their chores and sledded down the giant hill at the back of the property in their